What if God was black? What if freedom wasn't found in parliaments or pulpits, but in dreadlocks, drumbeats, and smoke rising from the hills of Jamaica? This is the untold story of Rastafari, a fire born from slavery, crowned by a king in Ethiopia, and carried by the voice of a barefoot prophet named Bob Marley. It's the journey of a people who turned pain into prophecy, exile into empire, and herb into holy scripture. From the blood of coral gardens to the dreams of Shashamane, this is not just a story, it's a revolution in spirit. The lion still roars, and the world is still listening. Welcome to the History of the Caribbeans podcast. If you haven't already, please consider following us on your favorite podcast platform. Today, we present to you Rastafari, A Journey Through Time, Episode 4. Let's dive into this thrilling narrative together. Chapter 13, Ethiopia is Calling. From the earliest whispers of Rastafari, one word echoed louder than all others. Louder than Babylon. Louder than chalice or dreadlock or psalm. A word that pulsed in the hearts of the faithful like an ancestral drumbeat. Zion. To the outsider, it was a metaphor. To the scholar, it was biblical poetry. But to the Rasta, Zion was no dream. It was no symbol. It was a destination, a place, a promise, a prophecy, a homeland stolen long ago, now calling her children back like a mother summoning the scattered bones of her family. And that homeland was Ethiopia. From the moment Haile Selassie, I was crowned in 1930, Rastas believed it was the fulfillment of Marcus Garvey's prophecy. Look to Africa, when a black king shall be crowned, for the day of deliverance is at hand. In Ethiopia, they saw Zion made flesh. It was the land of divine lineage, the seat of Solomon and Sheba, the only African nation to repel European colonization, a kingdom untouched, unbroken. To Rastas, Ethiopia was not just a country. It was redemption. It was the cure for Babylon. It was the land where they would walk free, farm in peace, worship under the sun without fear of persecution. It was the place where dreadlocks would be a crown, not a crime, where ganja could grow like gospel, where no one would ask, "Where are you from?" Because the answer would already be known. But prophecy must become action. And so they began to go. The Shashamane land grant, the promise of return. In 1948, Haile Selassie, I made an unprecedented gesture, moved by the loyalty of the African diaspora, especially those in the West Indies, who had declared him divine and defended his reign in sermons, songs, and spiritual devotion. The emperor granted 500 acres of land in the fertile region of Shashamane, Ethiopia. This land was given to members of the Ethiopian World Federation, EWF, an organization founded in New York in 1937 with Haile Selassie's blessing. It was a bold and sacred invitation, a key to Zion. And so, the dream of repatriation, long preached by Garvey and sung by Marley, became a tangible reality. But dreams, even divine ones, must pass through hardship. The journey to Ethiopia was not easy. Flights were expensive. Passports difficult. Many Rastas were denied travel documents by the Jamaican government, seen still as radicals and undesirables. Others left with nothing but faith and a few personal belongings, willing to trade Babylon's comfort for Zion's promise. The first waves of settlers arrived in the 1950s and 60s. Small groups, carrying the fire of Rastafari in their hearts, landed in Addis Ababa, then journeyed south to Shashamane. The land was green, rich, and generous. The climate was familiar, the soil fertile, but the cultural landscape was foreign. The settlers were met not with hostility, but with distance. Because while Ethiopia was revered by Rastas as holy ground, many Ethiopians saw these newcomers as outsiders. They wore robes and locks. They spoke in Patois and Iyarik. They smoked ganja openly and invoked the name of Haile Selassie not as a man, but as Jah himself. This was confusing, sometimes even offensive. Orthodox Christian clergy, deeply embedded in Ethiopia's religious identity, were cautious. The government, though welcoming in words, offered little in the way of infrastructure. There were no roads, no schools, no health systems built on the settlement. The land was real, but the support was not. Still, the Rastas stayed, built, planted, prayed. They constructed modest homes, raised children with Amharic names, tilled the land and shared crops. They held Nyabingi chants under starlight. They reasoned with Ethiopians when possible, and among themselves when not. Slowly, a new kind of life took shape, a repatriated liberty. Strangers in Zion, the pain of return. But even in Zion, there was pain. Repatriation was not a seamless homecoming. For many, it was a test of faith. They faced language barriers, bureaucratic hurdles, and cultural misunderstandings. Some Ethiopians saw the Rastas as strange Westerners clinging to an outdated fantasy. Others embraced them as brothers and sisters, long-lost kin finally come home. But unity was fragile. Rastas had expected to be welcomed as prophets returned to the throne of Jah. Instead, they often felt like foreigners, not fully Ethiopian, yet no longer Jamaican. Many who made the journey came with the belief that Haile Selassie would still be there to greet them. But by the time larger numbers arrived in the 1980s and 90s, the emperor had long been deposed. His palace was closed, his throne empty. The Derg government that had overthrown him was suspicious of Rasta ideology. Some settlers were harassed, others deported. And yet, they endured, because this was not just about land. It was about legacy. They had come to fulfill a spiritual contract. Even as Shashamane struggled, it remained holy ground, a beacon for Rastas across the globe. The land was living proof that prophecy could be fulfilled, not just in vision, but in soil. Generations of return, the Rasta village of Shashamane. By the 2000s, Shashamane had become a small, tight-knit Rasta enclave. Children born in Ethiopia now spoke Amharic. Elders walked barefoot across the same fields they had once wept over. New generations were building schools, community centers, and herbal medicine gardens. The dream had not died. It had simply transformed. Reggae festivals were held. Pilgrims from Jamaica, the UK, Trinidad, Ghana, and the US arrived in waves, seeking to walk the soil of Zion. Artists, historians, and spiritual seekers made their way to Shashamane as if to Mecca, to breathe the air, to feel the connection, to see where the lion had once roared. Some stayed, some could not, because repatriation, for all its beauty, required sacrifice. It meant leaving Babylon, yes, but also leaving behind electricity, comfort, and familiarity. It meant confronting who you thought you were and rediscovering who you truly are in the mirror of Africa. The dream and the dilemma, is Zion a place or a spirit? Today, the question remains, is Ethiopia the final destination or just the beginning of the journey? For some Rastas, the call to return physically remains as strong as ever. They still dream of building homes in Shashamane, of raising their children in the cradle of Jah, of dying in the soil of prophecy. But for others, the idea of Zion has evolved. It is no longer just about land. It is about mindset, about liberation within. Zion is wherever Babylon is rejected, wherever truth is spoken, wherever dreadlocks are worn with pride, wherever ganja is passed in peace, wherever Jah is called upon with full heart and clear conscience. Zion is not just in Ethiopia. Zion is in I&I. Ethiopia today, a new chapter. Modern Ethiopia is a complex place, rich with culture, challenged by politics, navigating the tension between tradition and change. The Rasta community in Shashamane remains, though small and under pressure. Land rights remain uncertain. Infrastructure is limited. Government policies fluctuate, but the spiritual foundation remains firm. Pilgrimages continue. Elders tend to their gardens. Youth born in Zion walk between two worlds, honoring their Caribbean roots and their Ethiopian birthright. The dream lives on in quiet rituals and bold declarations. And in the hills of Jamaica, in the cities of Toronto, London, and Cape Town, the call still echoes. Ethiopia is calling children, and the children, old and young, local and diasporic, are still listening. Chapter 14, Rasta and the World. Rastafari was born in the hills of Jamaica, but its soul was never meant to be confined to a single island. From its earliest chants and meditations, its spirit stretched outward across oceans, deserts, and continents, like smoke rising from a chalice, drifting into the lungs of a world desperately seeking truth. And the world heard the call. They heard it in the drumbeat of Nyabingi circles, in the verses of Marley's rebel songs, in the unwavering gaze of dreadlocked prophets who walked barefoot through Babylon, unmoved by ridicule, untouched by fear. And from the ghettos of Kingston to the back streets of Lagos, from the sound systems of London to the favelas of Brazil, people began to ask, what is this fire? Who are these people? And why does their spirit feel like mine? What followed was not a religion being exported. It was not doctrine being marketed. It was a resonance, a deep, undeniable frequency that vibrated through the wounds and dreams of the oppressed, the forgotten, the searching. Rastafari spoke of black divinity, freedom from empire, oneness with nature, and a life lived in defiance of systems that profited from spiritual slavery. And so it spread, not by force, but by fire. United Kingdom, Babylon within Babylon. One of the first places Rastafari took root outside Jamaica was in the United Kingdom. In the 1950s and 60s, waves of Caribbean immigrants, many from Jamaica, arrived in cities like London, Birmingham, Bristol, and Manchester. They came seeking work opportunity, a new life in the so-called mother country. What they found instead was Babylon in gray suits and concrete blocks. They were greeted with racism, housing discrimination, brutal policing, and economic exclusion. White residents called them invaders. Landlords posted signs that read, "No blacks, no dogs, no Irish." Police routinely stopped and searched black youth. Schools pushed them to the margins. But in the face of rejection, many Caribbean migrants turned inward, toward the memory of liberty, towards Rasta teachings, toward the smoke of ganja and the rhythm of dub. Rasta in the UK evolved as a form of spiritual armor, a way to reclaim dignity in a society built on denial. Dub poetry emerged from this fire, with voices like Linton Kwesi Johnson chanting down Babylon in British patois. Sound system culture flourished, turntables became pulpits, and lyrics became scripture. The Lion of Judah roared through speakers on foggy London nights, and in the hearts of Black Britons, a new form of identity was born. Part Jamaican, part African, part Rasta, all resilient. Africa returning to the source. Rastafari's arrival in Africa was not a foreign import. It was a homecoming. In countries like Ghana, Kenya, South Africa, Nigeria, and Senegal, Rasta resonated with young people looking for meaning beyond colonial Christianity or Western materialism. The message of Haile Selassie, an African king who stood unbowed before Western powers, was electrifying. The music of Bob Marley, Peter Tosh, and Burning Spear carried prophetic weight. But it wasn't just music, it was message. African Rastas began to reclaim lost histories. They grew locks as a statement of ancestral pride. They wore red, gold, and green not as fashion, but as flags of faith. They called for land reform, economic justice, and spiritual revolution. In South Africa, Rastas connected their struggles to apartheid and found inspiration in Marley's anthems of liberation. In Ethiopia, the Rasta community in Shashamane symbolized the return to Zion, even amid political tension. In Ghana, festivals like the annual Panafest gave voice to Afrocentrism, where Rastas marched with Pan-African banners beside Yoruba priests and Igbo historians. Rasta was not coming to Africa. It was reawakening within Africa. United States, concrete jungle prophecy. In New York, Chicago, Los Angeles, and cities across the U.S., Rastafari emerged in the same neighborhoods where Black Power, civil rights, and hip-hop were born. Harlem became a hub of Rasta thought in the 70s and 80s, influenced by Marcus Garvey's Pan-African legacy, and the voices of returned Jamaican immigrants who set up shops, community centers, and reggae dance halls. But American Rasta was distinct, urban, poetic, political. It interfaced with the Nation of Islam, Black Hebrew Israelites, and even elements of the 5% Nation. Rasta in the U.S. was often more academic, more engaged with theology, history, and Afrocentric philosophy. And in the underground, it merged with hip-hop. Artists like KRS-One, Dead Prez, and even Tupac Shakur channeled elements of Rasta consciousness in their lyrics, revolution, repatriation, and resistance. Though often misunderstood by the mainstream, American Rastas kept the fire burning in barbershops, basements, poetry slams, and on FM radio frequencies that reached the ears of those searching for something deeper than Sunday sermons and political slogans. South America and the Caribbean bloodlines and beats. In Brazil, Colombia, and Trinidad, Rastafari found familiar soil in the Afro-descendant communities, where slavery, colonialism, and resistance had already shaped a deep hunger for reconnection. In Brazil, particularly in Bahia, Rastas and followers of Candomblé found common ground. Reggae became the music of revolution, and Rasta teachings merged with Yoruba cosmology and the teachings of liberation theology. In Trinidad, Grenada, and St. Lucia, Rastafari became both spiritual refuge and social movement. Ganja use, Ital food, drum circles, and Nyabingi ceremonies flourished. Local reggae bands rose, echoing Marley's message, but singing in Caribbean tones. The Caribbean was not just where Rasta began, it was where it regenerated, redefined, and reincarnated across each island, adapting to language, rhythm, and resistance. Europe, Asia, and beyond, echoes of a lion. In Germany, France, Spain, Japan, and India, Rastafari was embraced, sometimes with reverence, sometimes with misunderstanding. European youth found in Rasta an alternative to capitalism, a spiritual response to alienation. Reggae festivals became sacred gatherings, fields of tents, rising chalices, live Nyabingi drumming. But with popularity came dilution. For every youth who read the teachings of Garvey, there were others who wore dreadlocks with no knowledge of Zion. In Japan, Rasta culture was adopted with precision and deep respect. Japanese Rastas learned patois, studied Selassie speeches, embraced Ital cuisine, and built entire reggae subcultures with discipline and devotion. In India, some saw parallels between Rasta and Shiva worship, with dreadlocks, ganja, and spiritual chanting aligning in symbolism. Small but passionate communities emerged in Goa and parts of southern India, where reggae was woven into local traditions. The challenge of globalization, between authenticity and influence. As Rastafari spread, a new challenge emerged. How do you keep the fire sacred when the world wants to sell the flame? In some places, Rasta was reduced to image, dreadlocks without reason, ganja without sacrament, reggae without revelation. Bob Marley's face became a poster in dorm rooms where no one knew of Coral Gardens or Pinnacle or Shashamane. Rastas began to ask, is this expansion or exploitation? Is this unity or dilution? The answer, as always, came through reasoning. Rastafari is not owned. It cannot be copyrighted. It cannot be sold. It is a living vibration. It is spirit. And spirit adapts, moves, evolves. But it must be respected. True Rasta teachers around the world now hold space for education, not just celebration. They build libraries, teach about Ital life, share the true meaning of liberty, of Selassie's legacy, of Marley's depth beyond his melodies. And in doing so, they protect the heart of the movement from becoming costume. The lion roars in many tongues. Rastafari today is spoken in many languages. In Spanish, Portuguese, French, Swahili, Chui, Japanese, Hindi, Arabic. But always, the root remains the same. Jah Live. Across the earth, dreadlocked youth still kneel before chalices, still chant down Babylon, still reason beneath the stars. They wear red, gold, and green, not as trend, but as testimony. And in that global heartbeat, Haile Selassie's vision endures. Not in palaces or parliaments, but in the breath of the oppressed, in the footsteps of the seeker, in the hands of those who plant seeds in dry land, trusting that rain will come. The world has embraced Rasta, but Rasta has embraced the world on its own terms. Chapter 15, In the Image of the Lion. Long before cameras and microphones, before lyrics and slogans, before red, gold, and green were stitched into cloth or flown on flags, Rastafari was a mirror. A mirror held up to a people who had been told, generation after generation, that they were nothing more than shadows, objects of labor, brokenness, and survival. A mirror that shattered the colonial gaze and whispered something different. You are divine. You are kings. You are queens. Your woolly hair is sacred, not savage. Your dark skin is not cursed, it is cosmic. Your ancestors were not slaves, they were stolen scholars, warriors, visionaries, architects of empires. You are not what Babylon says. You are what Jah sees. And in the reflection of that mirror stood the lion. Haile Selassie, I King of Kings, elect of God, became not just a political figure, but a spiritual archetype. He was the embodiment of dignity under pressure, royalty without apology, African sovereignty in an age of white supremacy. He walked among popes and presidents, bowed to none, and spoke in a voice so calm it carried earthquakes. Rastas looked at him and saw not just a man, but a reminder of what they could be. And in that vision, they remade themselves. The remaking of black identity. Before Rastafari, black identity in the West was shaped almost entirely by colonial narratives. From childhood, black people were taught that beauty looked like Europe, that God looked like Europe, that success, virtue, and civilization looked like Europe. Blackness was synonymous with savagery, sin, and shame. But Rastafari took a match to that narrative and set it on fire. It reclaimed Africa not as a pitiful past to escape, but as a glorious origin to return to physically, spiritually, and psychologically. It declared that Africa was not cursed, it was crowned. That Ethiopia was not backward, it was the cradle of kings. That the black body, the dreadlock form, the brown-skinned man and woman were images of the divine. And this reimagination of black identity was not abstract. It showed up visibly, in dreadlocks, worn not as fashion, but as defiance, as covenant, as crown, in Ital food, reclaiming the body from processed poison and reconnecting it to nature, in clothing, tunics, robes, turbans that echoed the sacred aesthetics of Africa, in language, Patois and Iaric, creating a new lexicon that replaced colonial concepts with affirmations of self, in music, where every beat of reggae was an act of testimony, an echo of ancient drums now tuned to the heart of modern resistance. In a world where blackness had been commodified, vilified, and dehumanized, Rastafari offered rehumanization. It said, "You are not what they told you. You are what your soul remembers." And this message began to ripple outward through poetry, fashion, film, literature, and most powerfully, through sound. Marley, as messenger, global lion speak. If Selassie was the lion in form, then Bob Marley was the lion in voice. Through him, the mirror of Rasta identity was held up not only to black people, but to all people. He sang for the rebel youth of Soweto, the forgotten villagers in Brazil, the revolutionaries in Palestine, the farm workers in Mexico, the dreadlock teens in Germany, Japan, South Africa, and Harlem. He carried the message of I and I, that dual awareness of self and divinity, to every corner of the earth. And he did it not with preaching, but with prophetic poetry. Emancipate yourselves from mental slavery. None but ourselves can free our minds. Those words did not simply inspire, they unshackled. They offered a way out of the cage, not just politically, but internally. The legacy of Marley was not merely fame or record sold. It was the reawakening of black spiritual confidence on a global scale. He reminded a scattered people that they were not lost, just waiting to remember. Rasta resistance, cultural, political, spiritual. The image of a lion, fierce, noble, untamed, became not just a symbol of identity, but a strategy of resistance. Rastafari has always been a protest movement, even when it did not march. Its protest was in its posture, its refusal to conform, its rejection of Western vanity, its questioning of everything, from capitalism to religion to mass media to colonial history. It taught that resistance begins inside, that by purifying the body, the speech, the thoughts, and the actions, one becomes a vessel of divine justice. And that resistance, though born in Jamaica, spread globally. In South Africa, Rasta principles aligned with anti-apartheid movements. In Brazil, they fueled Afro-Brazilian cultural pride and reclaiming of African spirituality. In France, they shaped Caribbean diasporic politics. In Canada, they helped form communities that taught Black youth about culture and self-love. In Africa, they inspired a new generation of spiritual seekers to look inward for liberation. The lion was roaring, not through armies, not through policy, but through example. Modern reflections, still roaring, still rising. Today, the influence of Rastafari is etched into the global soul. You see it in the pride of a Black woman wearing her natural hair unapologetically. You see it in the man who turns away from fast food and turns toward Ital living. You see it in the youth who chooses to read Marcus Garvey instead of mindless media. You see it in the chant, the prayer, the herb, the meditation, the refusal to sell out. And beyond race, Rasta has touched the conscious hearts of all people, Black, white, brown, and beyond, who seek to live in harmony with the earth, with the Most High, and with themselves. But the core remains Black liberation. That is where it started. That is what it has protected, and that is what it continues to ignite. In a time when image is everything, Rastafari reminds us that identity is more than appearance, it is alignment. To live in the image of the lion is to live in truth, justice, and spiritual clarity. It is to speak with courage, to eat with intention, to love with awareness, to walk with dignity, to never, ever forget where you come from, and to never allow another man's system to define who you are, in the image of a lion. So, what does it mean to be made in the image of a lion? It means to walk through Babylon unbent. It means to chant even when no one listens. It means to keep your roots deep in culture, even as your branches stretch toward the sky. It means to know your power and use it not to dominate, but to liberate. It means to carry the legacy of ancestors in every step. To honor Selassie not just with praise, but with principle. To hear Marley not just as a singer, but as a seer. To feel Zion not only in Shashamane, but in every sacred act of liberty. To be in the image of the lion is to remember that you were never lost, only hidden from yourself. But now, you see, and you roar. Chapter 16, The Spirit Never Dies. The fire never goes out. It may flicker in storms. It may dim in the shadow of doubt. It may hide beneath the ash of time, smothered by the weight of empire, commerce, politics, and persecution. But it does not die. The spirit of Rastafari is not a candle. It is a wildfire, and wildfires don't beg to be seen. They consume. They spread. They leave no illusion untouched. And from the hills of Jamaica to the streets of Johannesburg, from the ghettos of London to the highlands of Ethiopia, that flame still moves. It dances through language, beats through music, stirs in hearts, and settles in the bones of the faithful. Because Rastafari is not bound by geography, institution, or generation. It lives in the now. It lives in the spirit of rebirth, more than a movement, a way of life eternal. At its root, Rastafari was never about building cathedrals or dogmas. It did not seek to become a denomination, nor was it ever obsessed with doctrine. Rastafari is not something you wear on your chest or post on a wall. It is not just dreadlocks or ganja or red, gold, and green. It is not simply the name of Haile Selassie or the chant of Jah Rastafari. Rastafari is liberty, a way of being, of moving through the world with divine awareness, with a grounded knowledge that Babylon is not just a government, it is a mentality, that Zion is not just a place, it is a state of freedom wherever one finds it, that every act, from the food you eat to the words you speak, is either sacred or profane, and that you, in every breath, are building or burning the temple that is your spirit. That is what makes Rastafari immortal. It does not depend on numbers. It does not fear decline. It is a living vibration, passed not through seminars or missions, but through overstanding from one soul to another. It is revelation carried in music, in fire, in smoke, in silence. A message still echoing. The message of Rastafari was always simple, though never shallow. Know yourself. free your mind. Return to your roots. Honor the earth. Uplift your brother. Praise the Most High. Never bow to Babylon. And even now, decades after Selassie's reign, after Marley's voice was silenced, after the chalice circles of the early elders have faded into memory, the message continues to echo. In the beat of a new reggae song played on a dusty roadside in Accra. In the slow, deliberate gathering of herbs by a Rasta healer in Spanish Town. In the soft chanting of psalms by a mother in Addis Ababa, lighting incense in her son's name. In the fierce gaze of a dreadlocked youth in Trinidad who refuses to trim for a job interview because he knows his hair is a crown. In the tears of an elder in Shashamane who left Jamaica in the 1970s and still wakes before dawn to chant beneath the rising Ethiopian sun. This is not nostalgia. This is testament. The earth still groans. The mission is not done. The world Rastafari was born into has changed, but its wounds remain. Babylon still breathes. Oppression has new names. It wears suits. It runs algorithms. It smiles in advertisements. It poisons food, floods minds with noise, turns truth into commodity, and turns freedom into subscription. But Rastafari was made for times like these, because the same principles still apply. Even now, especially now, the world needs what Rastafari has always offered. Simplicity, consciousness, groundedness, unity, spiritual fire. The earth is groaning. The youth are restless. The lies are louder than ever. And still, somewhere in a corner of the world, a small Nyabingi drum circle begins. Just three elders, two candles, a chalice. They do not go live on Instagram. They do not ask for applause. But they keep the rhythm. They keep the spirit. Because Rastafari is not waiting for approval. It does not need to trend. It already exists in eternity. The next generation, carriers of the flame, the children of Rasta, born in and out of the movement, are rising. They may wear different clothes. They may speak in new tongues. Their rhythms may echo trap as much as roots reggae, but they carry the vibration. They ask the same questions. Who am I? Why was I lied to? What does it mean to be free? Where is home? And they are beginning to answer for themselves. Young Rastas are not waiting to be taught. They are digging, reading, questioning, challenging both Babylon and tradition. They are writing books, recording albums, growing food, building alternative schools, starting holistic health centers, reclaiming land, traveling to Ethiopia, to Ghana, to Inner Zion. They are not trying to copy the past. They are trying to continue it. And the elders watch, not with fear, but with joy. Because no flame looks exactly like the one that lit it. But the heat remains. The spirit of Selassie lives. Haile Selassie, I the man, the monarch, the symbol, is long gone from flesh. But in the eyes of those who overstood his purpose, he never left. He lives in the dignity of the poor man who walks proud. He lives in the patience of the woman who grows her food and raises her children on Ital principles. He lives in the voice of the elder who recites scripture by candlelight, with no need for microphones. He lives in the hands of the drummer, in the tongue of the poet, in the meditation of the faithful. His spirit, once tethered to crown and palace, now dwells among the people. He is no longer a king in a chair, but a presence in every act of righteous living. Until the color of a man's skin is of no more significance than the color of his eyes. That line was his, and it still judges the world. The spirit never dies. And so, as the final pages turn on this story, not of a man, but of a movement, what remains is not nostalgia. What remains is not sentiment. What remains is spirit. Rastafari is not gone. It is growing, in corners and circles. In hearts and frequencies, in silence and sound. The fire still burns in the forest of injustice. The drum still beats beneath the noise of empire. The chant still rises when no one is watching, because the spirit never dies. And for those who hear the call, whether in Kingston, in Addis Ababa, in Johannesburg, in Tokyo, or in Brooklyn, it comes softly, but unmistakably. Come forward. Repatriate your soul. Babylon is falling. Zion is rising. The time is now. And in response, the people rise. They rise with dreadlocks swinging and chalice burning. They rise with clarity in their minds and freedom in their steps. They rise in the image of the lion with the word of Jah on their lips and the vibration of righteousness in their breath. Because the spirit never dies. It only transforms. And now, it's yours.